It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. His artistry has entertained, inspired, engaged for six decades. The Andy Warhol Museum has been a cultural fixture for the Pittsburgh region and an international draw for a quarter century. That's right, the museum marked its 25th anniversary this week. Patrick Moore is the director of the Warhol Museum. Welcome to the Confluence and happy anniversary to you.
Thanks, Kevin. It's great to be here.
As I recall, the Warhol had a 24-hour event when it opened 25 years ago. You're sort of recreating that later this fall, aren't you not?
We are. On October 19th, we're going to have a gala to welcome guests from all over the world. And then on midnight of October 19th, we're going to open to the public free for 24 hours. And that is a kind of recreation, as you say, of back in 1994 when thousands and thousands of Pittsburghers lined up in the street because they were so excited that the Warhol was going to open here in Pittsburgh.
All right. And you're hoping for a similar reaction in October.
I think so, because Pittsburgh is so proud still that the Warhol is here.
Andy Warhol had a way of connecting with people. He died more than 30 years ago. Why do you think that Warhol, through his work, still connects with people?
You know, it's not just all people, although he does have a really broad influence. But what amazes me is his connection with young people. And I think that young people are drawn to Andy because, you know, there was this incredible openness about Andy. He famously welcomed people of all kinds into the factory, his studio in New York. It became a gathering place for gay people, straight people, high society people, and people who lived on the streets. You know, it was really an extraordinary moment in time in American culture where all sorts of people could come together. And I think that people sort of hunger for that again in American culture.
And that resonates with young people, you feel, today who are more maybe open, accepting, like Andy was?
Yeah, I think that young people have a wonderful quality about them. And it shows also in the kinds of people who come to the Warhol. We have an extraordinarily young audience at the Warhol. Our greatest number of visitors are between 25 and 35.
That's amazing because most of that age group wasn't even alive when he was alive.
That's exactly it. And you know, museums, fairly or not, kind of get a bad rap that people think that folks who come to museum are older. But at least at the Warhol, our audiences are young.
Mm-hmm. You can see a lot of Andy Warhol's pop art influence on artists working today, even some in advertising. What is it about pop art that made such a mark on the art world, do you think?
Pop art famously brought into the kind of hallowed halls of museums and galleries everyday objects. And Warhol said, you know, I'm going to walk down the aisles of a supermarket or I'm going to open the pages of a newspaper and I see beauty in everyday objects, and I'm going to break down these barriers, these walls, and I'm going to put these objects and these images onto canvases and onto museum walls. And, you know, whether you're the richest people in America or just the folks who live in the Hill District, everybody gets the same bottle of Coca-Cola. And what a refreshing and democratic idea that is.
Mm. The official date of the anniversary was Monday, correct?
That's right.
Okay. But that was just the beginning of the celebration. Give us a bit of what you have planned over the next months ahead.
Well, you know, as is typical at the Warhol, we really like to mix things up. And that's at the center of who Warhol was, too. So during this year of celebration, and it will extend into next year as well, because 25 years is a big deal, we're going to have really young artists, emerging artists, rockers, but we'll also take some deep dives into aspects of Warhol's work and life that people may not have known. So, for example, tonight at the Warhol Museum, we're going to have the fantastic rocker and artist Kim Gordon, famously of Sonic Youth, opening an exhibition.
You've had great response to that.
Absolutely. We're expecting 1,000 people tonight to come for the VIP preview, and that it opens to the public tomorrow. But then later this year, actually on the anniversary gala evening, October 19th, we're going to open this landmark exhibition that looks at Warhol's Catholicism. So many people don't know that Warhol was a deeply spiritual guy who was a devout Catholic.
He went to church regularly with his mom when he grew up in Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what do immigrants to our country have? But they have their folk traditions, they have their family, and really, fundamentally, oftentimes, they have their religion. And Andy and his family, the Warholas, were deeply religious, and that carried through until his death. He continued to go to Mass. He continued to go to church, and his last body of work were his famous Last Supper paintings. Mm-hmm. So we're going to mix all of that together.
So how did his mother and regularly attending Mass in Pittsburgh influence the artwork that's included in this exhibition that starts in October?
When Andy was a young man, he was kind of sickly. He had a condition called St. Vitus's dance, which is a neurological condition which causes a person to shake. And for nearly a year, Andy was in bed. And when he was in bed and a little boy at that time, what could a mother do with her child? So she would sit and color and draw with him. And Julia was herself an artist of a sort. And one of her favorite subjects was angels. She loved to draw cats and angels. So Julia would sit there and draw angels with her young son. And when she was sitting there drawing, she was teaching her son how to draw, but when she would draw angels, she was literally imparting her faith to her son. So in this exhibition, we're going to have Julia's drawings of angels. Mm. And what a beautiful thing to show your child through art what you believe in. And I think that that is the message of the exhibition. That no matter what we believe in, that art is a kind of window into a part of a person's personality, what they believe, that can kind of erase boundaries between people.
You could say that Andy Warhol put everyday items on sort of a pedestal, the icons of the Campbell soup camps, for example. Should we expect in this exhibition some maybe unconventional items to be placed on a pedestal in a sort of a glorified way, or even more traditional Catholic imagery?
Sure. Well, when you think of this enormous and beautiful pink Last Supper, which is one of Andy's last paintings, this is an image that many of us, whether we're Catholic or not, have seen a million times, the famous Last Supper painting. Andy helps us see it again with new eyes, with fresh eyes. And he paints the image again in this glowing pink color. And it's not in any way sacrilegious, but he helps us see something that we've seen so many times afresh. And this whole exhibition is curated by our extraordinary chief curator, Jose Diaz. And Jose has different sections to the exhibition, which really will call out different sections of Andy's work that relate to his Catholic upbringing.
Mm-hmm. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We are speaking with the director of the Andy Warhol Museum, Patrick Moore. And the museum is celebrating its 25th anniversary throughout the year and into next year. Throughout the years, the museum has sent traveling exhibits across the country and around the world. Have you noticed any impact from those shows on the rate of tourists coming to Pittsburgh?
We sure have. You know, the Warhol is one of the top tourist attractions here in Pittsburgh. And I really, you know, we hear about this thing called the Bilbao effect. The Guggenheim Museum famously opened a museum in Bilbao, Spain. And it was widely credited for transforming Bilbao. I don't know that the Warhol has done that for Pittsburgh, but I really think that culture is an important amenity for a city. It's what makes a world-class city, along with universities, along with industry. So when you think about Pittsburgh and the Renaissance, the most recent Renaissance that we're going through, I think that people do come here because they think, what are the world-class amenities that are in Pittsburgh? And certainly when people come to Pittsburgh as tourists or they're moving here and relocating here, they absolutely think, what is unique about this city? And the Warhol, along with many other fine things that we have here, is something that you can only find in Pittsburgh. So when we had those fantastic Chinese tourists who got on a charter flight last year and were our first direct flights from China to Pittsburgh, you better believe that they were talking to us about how they could come and see the Warhol. So we know that absolutely we have tourists who come here as a sort of pilgrimage to come and see the Andy Warhol Museum.
We have less than 2 minutes left. I wanted to ask you, Andy Warhol, of course, famously said, in the future, everyone will be world famous for 15 minutes. At the time, that was the late 60s. The internet wasn't even a fantasy for most people. Now with the advent of social media, it turns out Andy was right. What do you think he would have done with an Instagram account?
Andy would have been so busy on social media. You know, he loved to connect with people. Andy would have definitely reached out through social media. Andy also loved gossip, to tell you the truth. So he would have loved finding out what people were looking at, where they were, what they were doing. It would have been another way of connecting. But, you know, Andy also had very real personal relationships. So I bet he would have balanced the idea of reaching out through social media with the idea that he also would have kept in touch with people on a very personal level.
One of your predecessors as director of the Warhol, Tom Sokolowski, wanted the Warhol to be known as more than a museum, rather as a center for community dialogue through changing exhibitions, live music, and other things. Briefly, in a sentence or two, what still needs to be done so that the Warhol can continue to serve Pittsburgh as a community center?
Under my directorship, we have made the entirety of the Warhol about young people. Everything we do at the Warhol provides an opportunity for a young person to have greater opportunities in the world, have an impact on a young person, whether that's job skills or to reach out and find their place in the world. So the future of the Warhol is to provide opportunities for young people in the community.
Patrick Moore is the director of the Warhol Museum, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. Patrick, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks so much.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro sued Purdue Pharma this week. They're the company that made the painkiller OxyContin. This makes him the 39th AG in the nation to do so. So what's different about Shapiro's approach? And what about other makers of legal opioids? Then, educational apps developed by Carnegie Mellon University's RoboTutor will soon be used to teach 10,000 children basic reading, writing, and arithmetic skills in the Republic of Zambia. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde was released on this day in 1966, concluding his trilogy of rock and roll albums that began with Bringing It All Back Home and Highway 61 Revisited. Blonde on Blonde peaked at number 9 on the Billboard 200 and eventually sold over 2 million copies. It's also one of rock and roll's first double albums. Some of the album's songs have become pillars in Dylan's canon. Take a moment and think of a Bob Dylan song. Did Visions of Joanna, Just Like a Woman, or Stuck Inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues Again cross your mind? Or maybe you thought of Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat or Rainy Day Women numbers 12 and 35. You see what I mean? For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
A lot of single-use plastic ends up polluting oceans. Think plastic straws. And most of it ends up in the trash. But what if more plastic could be recycled? This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. You know you're not supposed to put things like plastic grocery bags in your regular recycling bin because they can create a huge headache for the recycling industry. But now recyclers are experimenting with technologies to find a second life for plastic bags, candy wrappers, and other flexible plastic packaging. WHYY's Dana Bate has this story.
I'm standing inside a recycling plant near Reading, Pennsylvania. A front loader pushes, lifts, and dumps just some of the 500 to 600 tons of waste the plant processes every day. I'm here to spot stuff that traditionally is not supposed to be here.
Your Go-Gurt packs, your applesauce containers, the inside liner of your cereal box, your Purina dog food bags, chip bags, snack bags, Snickers wrappers.
That's TJ Stinson, recycling coordinator at JP Mascaro & Sons. The stuff he's talking about is called flexible plastic packaging and also includes things like plastic shopping bags and shrink wrap.
I can see the bags and the plastic in there already. Like, there's tons of it already.
Absolutely, and it's already going to be a part of the mixture there. We estimate it to be 1% of our total intake now, and that number will only go up.
1% of 500 means at least 5 tons of plastic packaging that until recently, the company wasn't set up to handle. Plastic bags and other flexible plastics get stuck in sorting equipment and can grind the works to a halt. And they can't be processed with thicker plastics like water bottles. JP Mascaro is trying to change that. They've launched a pilot project to recycle this flexible plastic instead of sending it to the landfill. The new sorting equipment blows the lightweight plastic to separate it from things like paper and thicker plastics, and eventually it's suctioned up through a vacuum onto a conveyor belt. Later, it's packed with similar material into a bale. Right now, all of this stuff has gotten here mistakenly. The company isn't ready for people to start putting these products in their recycling bins. JP Mascaro just wants to test its new sorting equipment to make sure it works, and it's shopping around to see who could turn all of this flexible packaging into something useful.
What we are trying to do is get all of the packaging material that currently goes in the landfill, get it into our building, accumulate it, and find a new market that we can put it back to use, give it a second life.
It's still unclear what that second life will be. The best uses so far include products like corrugated pipes or decking materials like the brand Trex. There's a challenge in imagining next generation products made from these flexible plastics. They contain impurities, so they can't be used for medical products or anything involving food. That brings us back to decking and other building materials, or maybe a fuel like biodiesel. But Grace Swan, an environmental engineer at Drexel University, says some of those options could be very expensive and use more energy than is being saved by recycling this stuff.
It's a good idea, but sometimes a good idea may turn out not to be so ideal at the end because the process is so complicated and so energy demanding.
That hasn't dissuaded environmental management specialist Susan Graff, who is spearheading the research that led to the pilot project back in Reading. She says these hard-to-recycle plastics are a reality of modern life.
It's everywhere. Let's not set up to landfill it. Let's do the science.
The science to turn these plastics into something useful. I'm Dana Bate in Philadelphia.
And you can find more stories about plastic recycling at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Kara Holsapple.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A special election to replace Republican Congressman Tom Marino will take place Tuesday, the same day as the primaries. Marino easily won re-election in November in the 12th District, which covers a large swath of central and northern Pennsylvania. But he resigned 3 weeks into his new term, first saying he would take a job in the private sector, then citing health concerns. WITF's Rachel McDevitt reports two candidates are vying for voters' attention in the solidly Republican district.
Democrat Mark Friedenberg lost a bid for the 12th congressional district seat by 32 percentage points in November, but he was quick to run again in this month's special election.
There's a reason you'll play the game, right? There's a reason that we have the election. I mean, you could look at the White House and President Trump and say, well, nobody thought that he was going to be able to make it there either.
The 35-year-old lawyer and cybersecurity instructor at Penn State is running against Republican Fred Keller, who has represented parts of Snyder and Union counties in the state House since 2011. Before entering politics, the 53-year-old was a plant operations manager for a Conestoga Woods specialties facility. While Friedenberg criticizes Keller as a career politician who, quote, does what he's told, Keller argues he focuses on results and doesn't vote in lockstep with his party.
I've been accessible. I've listened. I've made decisions. I haven't followed the party line. I've done what I said I'm going to do.
In the race's only debate, Friedenberg emphasized his support for improving rural internet access and safeguarding entitlement programs.
It means that we need to protect programs that help every American live and retire with dignity. Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security.
Keller said his focus is on growing the economy, taking care of veterans, and limiting government.
We can't afford to go and have things like the Green New Deal and socialized medicine that take choices away from people rather than letting them define what they want to have.
Though Friedenberg stresses the importance of fighting climate change, he is noncommittal on the Green New Deal. The proposed framework for drastically reducing carbon emissions while creating jobs stalled in the U.S. Senate this spring. The dynamics of this special election, happening during an off-year municipal primary in a heavily Republican district, favor the GOP candidate. Friedenberg's hope is to drive Democratic enthusiasm in the race, but some voters in the area seem to be more concerned with national politics. At Dolly's Diner outside Williamsport, retired teacher Chris Bauer says he's been following the race a little, but he hasn't picked who he'll vote for.
I'm pretty much a conservative Democrat, I think, which is kind of tough these days, you know.
But he says he's fairly fed up with Republicans for their lack of oversight of the president.
I just said I can't support Mr. Trump and everything he stands for, but many times it's just because of the, the personality issues, the basic immorality, I think, that goes along with him.
In rural Wyoming County, retired mechanic Dan Klein already has two large Trump 2020 signs hanging on his property.
I think he's, for what they've allowed him to do, I think he's doing fantastic. But they just block him everywhere they can.
But when it comes to this year's congressional race,
I don't follow it that close because, like I say, the whole problem with the whole system, there's too many of them. And they make it so complicated you can't put a name to somebody.
If the race hasn't caught voters' attention yet, it could early next week. Donald Trump is scheduled to appear at a rally supporting Keller on Monday. Rachel McDevitt in Harrisburg.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This week, Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro filed suit against Purdue Pharma, the maker of the painkiller OxyContin. That makes him at least the 39th Attorney General in the nation to do so, and he is on the line right now. Mr. Attorney General, thanks for taking the time.
Great to be with you.
Dozens of states have sued the drug maker. You told my colleague Megan Harris on this program last month that you didn't want a deal like the one Oklahoma got. They won, but you said it wasn't good enough. What's different about your approach?
Well, what's different about our approach is that it began really 2 years ago when I took office. We organized a coalition of 41 states as one of the leaders in that coalition to investigate six opioid manufacturers, including Purdue Pharmaceutical, and three distributors who combined are responsible for more than 90% of our nation's opioids that are out in the marketplace. And we thought it was important to conduct a full and thorough investigation and to have dialogue with these companies and see if they were serious about, you know, paying for the damage that they created in communities like ours all across Pennsylvania. And I reached a point during the course of that investigation where I felt that Purdue, given all of the significant contributions they made to this crisis, wasn't serious about dealing with their past conduct and helping Pennsylvania be able to move forward. And so I took them to court. And you're correct that we're the 39th state, but what I think that misses is that we are the only state, through our complaint, that has been able to show this web between the detailers or the drug reps and their conduct in doctors' offices and the directions they were getting from, you know, the corporate executives to push this dangerous opioid product out in the market, to lie about its addictive nature. And ultimately, as a result of their conduct, they provided the jet fuel to this crisis. It's wrong. It's unlawful. And that's why we've taken Purdue to court.
So what are you seeking from Purdue?
Well, we want Purdue to pay for their conduct. We want to make sure that they make Pennsylvania whole again for the cost. It's estimated that for every life lost, it costs the Commonwealth $9.7 million. We know that we continue to lose 12 Pennsylvanians every single day to this crisis. And we also know that for as much destruction as this has caused to human life and families and our economy in Pennsylvania, man, for Purdue, opioids have been a goldmine. They've made more than $35 billion in revenue since OxyContin's release back in 1996. And to be clear, they're not the only maker of opioids. They're not the only ones who have culpability here, but they've got a lot of it because of the way in which they lied about the addictive nature, because of the way they use their sales force to peddle this product out into our communities. And we want them to pay up. We want them to stop this destructive behavior. And we want to make sure they're part of the solution, not the problem.
Have you asked for a certain figure?
Well, no, what we did in our lawsuit was we laid out the specific damages that they've inflicted upon this Commonwealth. And we will be seeking damages commensurate with the pain that they've caused.
You mentioned drug reps. Drug reps for years have been visiting doctors' offices to talk about new medications. What's different in how Purdue Pharma engaged in this common practice?
Purdue bombarded Pennsylvania doctors with more than 500,000 sales visits. That's more than any other state in the nation, with the exception of California, which is obviously much larger than Pennsylvania population-wise. And in their sales visits, they targeted doctors who in turn would target vulnerable populations, specifically our veterans and our seniors here in the Commonwealth. We have large, you know, populations of both. And in doing so, they sought out doctors who would prescribe these at alarmingly high rates to get them to patients, to lie to those doctors and patients saying that these weren't addictive drugs. And when they began to develop addiction, their answer to that was more doctor's visits and more pills, saying that you needed more opioids in order to combat what you were experiencing. And their conduct was absolutely outrageous. And when you think of it, 4 out of every 5 heroin users starts with a legal prescription drug like an OxyContin. In fact, the makeup of an OxyContin is nearly identical to the makeup of heroin in terms of the chemical makeup of it. And so what you saw was this progression of vulnerable populations like our veterans going from OxyContins that were being pushed through these sales reps ultimately to using heroin, and sadly for many of them, succumbing to their addiction.
You say that Purdue downplayed addiction. Is deception something that you can prosecute?
It's something that we allege in our complaint, and it's one of the reasons why we're taking them to court.
Do we know that the company knew just how addictive the painkillers would be?
Yes, and it's spelled out in our complaint.
Are you saying that the company is directly responsible for deaths? And if so, can they be charged with something like negligent homicide?
What I'm saying is the company knew and turned a blind eye to the addictive nature. They lied about it, and they tried to cover that up. As for what we may or may not do in the future as it relates to additional steps on the civil side or even possibly criminal charges, I'm not going to discuss that in this forum. Suffice to say, as I've been saying on your program and others for the last couple of years, we're taking a multi-pronged approach to dealing with this crisis that involves both criminal and civil charges.
It's important to note that Purdue Pharma, of course, has denied your allegations. You said previously that I believe you were negotiating with Purdue and maybe some other drug makers. So that didn't work out with Purdue?
I didn't feel that Purdue was seriously negotiating with our office, given the amount of culpability they have, given the amount of destruction they've caused to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I didn't feel that, you know, what they were discussing with us was in line with their, you know, their negative conduct.
What about talks with other makers of prescription painkillers? Are they happening? Are more suits possible against these other drug manufacturers?
Talks with others continue. As I said, we are investigating 6 manufacturers and 3 distributors. So Purdue is just one of those 9 companies. The other 8 we continue to talk to, and I think continue to make progress. But I won't hesitate to go to court if we have to. But if we can negotiate this out, we can come to a fair resolution. I always prefer to do that. I think that's quicker relief for the people of Pennsylvania.
Have you sort of set in your head a timeline of when you want an agreement with these others before you take the next step, the legal step?
You know, the timeline is always as soon as possible, but I'm also mindful of the fact that these processes take some time. And so we will, you know, take the time necessary to do it right. I don't establish artificial timelines.
Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro, thanks so much for taking the time with us.
Always good to be with you. Thank you.
Later today, the Attorney General's office makes its case to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to intervene and modify a consent decree between UPMC and Highmark to ensure that UPMC abides by its charitable obligations to protect patient access to affordable care. Shapiro declined to comment on today's court appearance, but we will have more throughout the day and on this program tomorrow. Stay with us. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. RoboTutor, a team based at Carnegie Mellon University, will use its educational apps to teach thousands of children in Zambia basic reading, writing, and math skills. Amy Organ is a professor of human-computer interaction at CMU and one of the team leaders of RoboTutor. Amy, welcome to The Confluence.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, your team was a finalist for the $10 million Global Learning X Prize. Congratulations on being a finalist.
Thank you.
I have to ask you, why Zambia?
Well, Zambia is a really exciting place to be because we've got so many excellent partners that are helping us prepare things on the ground so that children are in the right space to begin learning. So they have already delivered thousands of pairs of shoes so that children have shoes available to walk to school. They have food programs available so that children have the nutrition that they need to go to school and not be hungry. And so now these kids are in a perfect spot where they're ready for learning, and we can bring to them this additional support for basic literacy and numeracy that they really need.
Mm. So what's the purpose of the project of the apps themselves?
So the goal is to support children in gaining basic literacy and numeracy skills, which are the foundation for all of the rest of an educational experience. And so the system is intended to augment and support what the teacher is doing in the classroom, but also make available these learning opportunities for children who aren't able to make it to school on a daily basis.
Age range?
About 7 to 10, but we've actually had children use it who are as young as 4 years old, and they're really excited by the interactions that they can have playing the games and engaging with their peers and the other children in the school to learn.
Getting kids excited about learning at the earliest possible age must be gratifying.
Oh, it's so wonderful to see their reactions when they play these games and when they actually see themselves making progress and learning new skills.
Now, the apps for the kids are to help them teach themselves some basic literacy and the math skills. Is there a lack of teachers or what?
Well, in fact, there is a lack of teachers at the moment. One of the wonderful things that's happening around the world is that more and more children are able to actually go to and access schooling. So that's a fantastic problem to have. But what that means is that there's not always sufficient teachers to be able to handle every classroom. And so you get class sizes that are 90 or 100 students with one teacher. There's an estimate that almost 20 million teachers are missing in Africa at the moment. And it's going to take a long time before we can train enough teachers to be in every classroom. So in the meantime, technology could really help.
So good news, bad news. Good news, so many kids are available to go to school, just not enough teachers there.
That's right.
Okay. So what research into the way people learn is done prior to the development of the app?
So, of course, we always start with decades of research in the learning sciences. So we know a lot now about exactly the ways that children acquire literacy, how they start learning numbers and letters, and how they move to more complex mathematics subjects. We also want to really make sure that what what we're building is supportive of learners who are in a particular context. So they're in these classrooms in Zambia with these particular features. And so we also do a lot of work. My field is human-computer interaction. So we look to understand exactly how children engage with these technologies beyond the learning sciences research so that what we're building actually works for those kids specifically.
So are there sort of from that research, are there universal basics of the learning process and then you blend in cultural, geographic specifics?
Yes, that's exactly the process. So it involves a lot of work by a lot of researchers all around the world to understand those fundamental building blocks. And then we go very closely into the context. We observe how classrooms work in Zambia or in Tanzania, where we've been working for a long time now. Talk with teachers, do interviews with children, watch them use the software, and then we incorporate all of those results into the final product.
I understand you developed the software in both Swahili and English. Swahili for the field tests in Tanzania and English for Zambia?
That's right. So Swahili is a common language across a number of East African countries. English also happens to be the language of schooling in a much wider set of countries across Africa. So by expanding the capabilities and building it in multiple languages, we have the ability to reach more children.
Are there any plans to incorporate indigenous languages of Zambia into the app?
Yes, so we think that it's really important that children learn in their mother tongue and that they have access to that sort of approach. It's also important that they learn the language of commerce and employment in that country so that they can continue their education and then find a really great job when they get out. So we like working across languages.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple of minutes left. The apps... they involve sort of a regimented approach to learning. Are there some options for the kids?
So we take a blended approach. The children have a lot of choice when they go into the app, but also the app knows a lot about what the children know, and it's able to guide them and put them at the right level of learning so that they're not either struggling or bored, on the other hand, with things that are too easy.
Mm-hmm. How does RoboTutor work with areas when it comes to maybe resource inequity? In other words, lack of access to tablets.
Yes. So understanding what technology is available in a community and whether electricity and other features are really important in order to know whether technology is a good solution. So the competition used tablets, which is something that's not common in many places. So we're looking at moving towards smartphones and even down to basic phones to try to work with technology that already exists in the communities.
You didn't win the $10 million first prize, but you're still proceeding with the project. How much is it going to cost, though, to implement what you want to do?
Yes, so there are implementation costs, and those are things that we're going to have to find. And one of the benefits of working in this area is that there are a lot of funders who are really excited about helping these children get access to education. So that's our next step, is finding those folks who want to support us in this project.
All right. In our last minute, you didn't win the prize, as I said, the $10 million. Still proceeding. But what changes, adjustments might you be considering now? You mentioned moving away from tablets. Anything else?
Yes, so we've learned a lot through this process. We've got a lot of data coming back to us, and we can make lots of better decisions now that we've seen children use it for almost 2 years in the field. So we've got lots of ideas about how to make it even better.
Can you incorporate those ideas quickly into it so it can really get on the ground moving with these kids?
Yeah, that's exactly the plan. We've got lots of data, and we have quick fixes that we can use to make it much better in the near term.
Amy Organ is a professor of human-computer interaction at CMU's Human Computer Interaction Institute, one of the team leaders of RoboTutor, a CMU-based team whose app will help 10,000 children in Zambia develop reading, writing, and math skills. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together. Next time, Pennsylvania Supreme Court is being asked to intervene to extend decree so that people with Highmark insurance can continue seeing UPMC medical providers at in-network rates. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich and Julia Maruka. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.